Hello, this is Alton Banks from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Now diving into this week's Triangle Business Journal, of course, we make our first stop at the biz page. And there are about five articles here that we'll take a look at. And the first is on student market. And the article is entitled, Raleigh Developer Launches New ECU Student Housing. In 1918, just a few years after East Carolina University was founded in Greenville, Todd Said's grandparents emigrated to the United States from Lebanon and put down roots in the city, opening Said's department store downtown. A century later, Said is helping to change the student housing landscape in the growing college town. Raleigh-based DeWitt Carolinas, founded by Said and Vin Poole, recently received approval to build an 804-bed, 8-story dorm building just off the campus of ECU. Construction is supposed to begin this summer. If all goes according to plan, the dorm rooms could open to students for the fall semester of 2020. The project will sport a swimming pool atop an 8-story parking deck with a view of ECU's football stadium. Everett Daniels, president of DeWitt, says when he attended ECU, most of the places to live off campus were houses and rundown party places that were far away from the university. The $85 million dorm project is supposed to change that equation, he says. And also on the biz page under the heading of Old Country comes the article Celebrating British Style. The United Kingdom celebrated the first year of its trade office in Raleigh on January 25th with a sumptuous event at the Womble, Bond, Dickinson Law Offices in downtown, where Representative Andrew Terrell has his office. Terrell thanked a large crowd that included North Carolina Secretary of Commerce Tony Copeland and gave out a number of commendations. Among those attending were Steve Malik, who's pursuing Major League Soccer, and Sally Webb, the CEO of the Special Events Company. Webb, by the way, was scheduled to accept a Lifetime Achievement Award February the 1st at Special Events Magazine's Gala Awards in New Orleans. And now under the heading of Opposing Incentives, the article Author Cautions Cities on Amazon. Richard Florida of the University of Toronto identified the creative class as a key driver of the region's economic future in a 2004 book that became a national bestseller. And those smart, creative people have emerged as a key demographic coveted by cities that want to grow. But Florida and other academics and others who follow business closely are urging cities to be careful when it comes to pursuing Amazon's second headquarters. In a letter posted on change.org, his group urges the finalists to sign a mutual non-aggression pact that would reject egregious tax giveaways and direct monetary incentives for Amazon. Tax giveaways and business location incentives offered by local governments are often wasteful and counterproductive, according to a broad body of research, the group writes. Such incentives do not alter business location decisions as much as is often claimed, the letter states. Worse, they divert funds that could be put to better use, underwriting public services, such as schools, housing programs, job training, and transportation, which are more effective ways to spur economic development. The petition had more than 600 supporters as of January 31st. Now under the heading of Honored comes the article, Wine Enthusiasts Celebrate with Governor on Big Night. Eliza Kraft Olander, chair of the Triangle Wine Experience, known as TWE, for the past 25 years, recently received the Order of the Longleaf Pine Award from Governor Roy Cooper at the Executive Mansion. The ceremony also included the recognition of volunteers who helped make the TWE happen. Some of the Triangle elite who were there to celebrate with Olander included YMCA of the Triangle CEO Doug McMillan, Restaurateur Ashley Christensen, Angus Barnes sommelier Hank Scheitmaker, Raleigh Mayor Nancy McFarlane, entrepreneur Rich Lee, and the Avett brothers Joe Kwan. It was also announced that the TWE will help raise money for the fires that devastated Napa and Sonoma in October, by auctioning off 25 cases of unique wine, spearheaded by California winemakers Steve Reynolds and Pam Starr. The auction will be held June the 15th and 16th in Raleigh. And in the heading of Big Demand comes the article, North Carolina Ready to Wing It as Super Bowl Approaches. Want some chicken wings for the Super Bowl? That will cost you. The Super Bowl is coming, and with it, America's continuing obsession with chicken wings. That's not such a bad thing for North Carolina, which ranks fourth nationally in chicken production. It used to be a big tobacco state. We flipped from crops to livestock, says Bob Ford, the longtime executive director of the North Carolina Poultry Federation in Raleigh. 20% of North Carolina's poultry products are sold overseas, Ford says, and the underdeveloped countries are becoming bigger markets as people there gain income and widen their food choices. Chicken seems to be the first choice they go to, he says. Interest in wings continues to explode. One company reported wing prices were up 21.4% in a year. 30 years ago, when I first started in the industry, you couldn't give them away, Ford says. He adds, it'd be nice if we could breed a chicken that had four wings. And finally, on today's biz page comes the article, Carry to Join Rush to Build Condos in Downtown. Luxury condos and apartments are rising across the urban cores in the Triangle, and now some are planned for downtown Cary as well. Jordan Gussenhoven of Chatham Street Commercial believes the time is right for a similar project only a couple of blocks from the center of Cary, which has undergone rapid transformation recently. With a critical mass of retail tenants, new restaurants, and food downtown, we felt like there was a need for residential close to downtown, Gussenhoven says. He expects luxury apartments downtown eventually will come as well, but that this project will straddle a location between the town and nearby neighborhood. The development, called Chatham Walk, will include 33 condominiums, with prices starting at $300,000. To make way for Chatham Walk, the developers are moving the Williams House, a quaint, modernist structure that dates to the 1930s when Cary was just a small crossroads. It was home to Felton and Margaret Williams, whose claim to fame was that Felton worked at WPTF, and they were married over the air. The house will move a few blocks away, but its modern look served as inspiration for Chatham Walk's design. Gussenhoven and his uncle, George Jordan III, have been involved in many Cary projects, and Gussenhoven says he's eager to see the transformation downtown Cary continues. We've been excited to see it develop, he says. You hope what you think is coming will occur. Now Gussenhoven is happy to sell you a condo, but if you want your marriage broadcast, well, that's up to you. Now we turn to the On Technology and Banking page, and the first article is Investors Thrilled as Ford Acquires Transloc. For some of Transloc's largest backers, news that Transloc was being acquired by a subsidiary of Ford Motor Company meant a quick payday. For its CEO, Doug Kaufman, it meant the mission could continue in a big way as, armed with Ford's wallet, the company will push forward as part of its mobility group. I think we fit in a variety of areas. Their vision is improving mobility for everyone, Kaufman says. We're a mission-based company, and this enables us to go after that mission in ways we couldn't have dreamed of before. And that mission will continue to take place in Durham, where Ford has talked up the access, the university, and the quality of life, Kaufman adds. The exit comes less than 2 years after Transloc, $8 million founder, co-led by SJF Ventures, a mission-based investor in Durham. Dave Kirkpatrick, managing director of SJF, happily admits it's faster than the 5-year window his firm typically targets. We're thrilled, he says. The reasons his team invested were some of the same reasons it's a good deal, he says. When SJF made its investment, it was attracted to great energy from the management team and was also lured by the industry. And under the heading of Next Steps comes the article, Atlantic Coast Pipeline Preps for Construction. While economic developers were celebrating January the 26th, the day state regulators gave the Atlantic Coast Pipeline the water certificate it needs to build in North Carolina, Others, including Nash County farmer Marvin Winstead, were very, very disappointed. "We feel like this is the wrong decision," Winstead said. "We're disappointed at the lack of leadership from Governor Cooper." ACP wasted no time in formalizing its plan, even though it still has a handful of permits to acquire before it actually builds the natural gas pipeline in the state. ACP spokesman Aaron Ruby said January the 29th, the firm was ready to begin limited tree felling and vegetation clearing in Robeson and Cumberland counties. "Tree felling will continue through the end of March," he said in an email. "All trees will remain along the right-of-way until we receive remaining federal approval to clear trees and begin other construction work," Ruby said. "After that, I notice to proceed with full constructions expected by the spring," he said. And under the heading of Outlook comes the article, SAS Leader Outlines Goals. SAS Institute reported $3.24 billion in operating revenue for 2017. That's up 1.25% from 2016. Top executives hope to boost further growth through reorganization and innovation. Oliver Schabenberger, recently named Chief Operating Officer, says a new Internet of Things division would help tap into an emerging industry. His top goal for 2018 and beyond is to grow revenue profitability, followed by an emphasis on customers. "We're a customer-driven company," Schabenberger says. "The third goal is to make sure everybody who has an analytics problem is aware that they can benefit from SAS. The days when analytics were only accessible to someone with a PhD in analytics, that is, a data scientist, they're gone," he says. And under the heading of Seeking Land comes the article, Durham Orange Rail Remains Priority. While it's still years away from construction and still subject to federal funding decisions, the Durham Orange Light Rail Project continues to be a major priority for Regional Transit Agency Go Triangle in 2018, General Manager Jeff Mann says. Last summer, the federal government gave Go Triangle permission to enter into the engineering phase, a $100 million effort that takes the project from 30% to a final design. As design work continues, Mann says plans are also progressing for what officials call the ROMF, that's the Rail Operations and Maintenance Facility. Go Triangle has made offers to all 9 property owners whose 15 parcels make up the ROMF, space that will not only accommodate staff, but also have the space to store, service, and maintain up to 26 light rail vehicles. Mann says those negotiations with landowners are progressing, but declined to comment further. In Go Triangle's January update memo to Orange County commissioners, the agency told officials that if settlements aren't reached, Go Triangle would request authorization from the board to acquire any remaining parcels by eminent domain. The facility wants to start construction in 2019. According to the memo, the overall project is still on track to finish 50% of the design work by March. Stakeholders, including Durham, Chapel Hill, and the North Carolina Department of Transportation, will review the plans and provide comments to Go Triangle. The project is expected to complete 75% of the design phase this fall and finish in 2019. That's when Go Triangle hopes to obtain the full federal funding agreement for the project so that construction can get started. North Carolina Department of Transportation Secretary Jim Trogdon says the North Orange Light Rail, along with Complete 540, are the two most impactful projects in the triangle. And he's not worried that the feds won't fund the more than $1.2 billion in grants the Durham Orange Project is counting on. "Jeff is doing exactly what I would do," he says. "You work every possible alternative to achieve success. And if what doesn't work, you may have one or two or three more in process. There's no single path to success on any of these, and both of them are so impactful that not delivering either of these would be bad for the region." Now turning to the On Health Care page in this week's Triangle Business Journal, comes the article, Goodnight Makes Major Bet on Novan. With Marshfield-based Novan raising upward of $35 million in a public offering earlier this month, SAS CEO Jim Goodnight has upped his investment in the company, with his Reedy Creek Investments firm becoming the company's largest stockholder. According to a January the 22nd SEC filing, Reedy Creek bought about 3.9 million shares of the company's common stock and an additional 3.9 million convertible warrants, representing 26.4% of Novan's shares of common stock outstanding. The aggregate purchase price of $15 billion was paid from Reedy Creek's investment capital, the filing states. It's our general policy not to discuss the investments made by the James Goodnight Management Trust or Reedy Creek Investments LLC, SAS Chief Finance Officer Don Parker said. There are no immediate plans to make additional investments in Novan. According to the filing, Goodnight is the sole trustee of the trust, which owns a majority of the equity interest in Reedy Creek. The investment comes as Novan is pivoting from a primary focus on acne to a broadened focus on the areas of virology and immunology. Aside from Reedy Creek, Novan's largest shareholders include Madeline Life Science Holdings, Cree co-founder Neil Hunter, Mark Schoenfisch, and former Novan CEO Nate Stasko. Reedy Creek owns upward of 11% of Malincorp PLC, which owns 100% of MLSH. The company's market capitalization currently hovers around $93 million, with about 26 million shares outstanding. And in other news on the healthcare front comes the article, Triangle Gains Public Company with Reverse Merger. Raleigh's Innovate Biopharmaceuticals, which has drugs to treat celiac disease and ulcerative colitis in the pipeline, is a Triangle's latest public company with the closing of a reverse merger with Monster Digital of Simi Valley, California. Shares of Innovate will begin trading January 31st on the NASDAQ under the new ticker symbol INNT, and will also reflect the 1-for-10 reverse split at that time. We've been looking forward to this for a while, Innovate President Jay Madden says. Going public and the resulting access to the capital markets provides the company the means to move its product candidates for celiac disease and ulcerative colitis into Phase 3 and Phase 2 clinical trials, respectively. The concurrent funding, more than $21 million we received, will allow us to advance both of the trials, says Kendall Woodard, Director of Operations and Investor Relations at Innovate. We've got a great team in place around both of our molecules. The next step will be to have the phase three trials for larazotide acetate, which is our lead molecule, for celiac disease, which is an unmet need that affects approximately 1% of the population. That step is slated for a launch in the second quarter. According to Madden, Innovate is targeting a submission of its new drug application to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in late 2019 or early 2020. Larazotide acetate has been granted Fast Track designation or expedited review from the FDA. Celiac disease is a genetic autoimmune disease. Innovate also will be looking into additional indications, one of which includes the liver disease non-alcoholic streptohepatitis, says Madden. The company believes its molecule will have potential for that indication, he adds. Last month, ahead of the reverse merger's closing, Innovate raised $1.45 million for general operations and costs associated with the reserve merger. The reverse merger, less expensive and time-consuming than an initial public offering, as previously noted by Woodard, saw Monster Digital complete a spin-off transaction for certain assets and liabilities not assumed by Innovate in the deal. Now a couple of short articles is on a new member. NCCU joins other Triangle schools in partnership. North Carolina Central University has partnered with Triangle University's nuclear lab that uses an acronym TUNL, Tunnel, a U.S. Department of Energy Center of Excellence in Nuclear Research formed more than a half century ago. Funded primarily by the Department of Energy, Tunnel attracts about $25 million for research in the region during every three-year funding cycle, according to NCCU. About 50% of the school's physics faculty has been involved with Tunnel over the years, says Mohammed Ahmed, associate professor of mathematics and physics at NCCU. The Triangle is a great economic hub for nuclear research, Ahmed says. And finally, on the healthcare page comes the article, CCNC Adds Executives Across North Carolina. Community Care of North Carolina is building its executive ranks as North Carolina's Medicaid moves to a managed care model from a fee-for-service model. CCNC has added three new regional vice presidents to build a greater understanding of what's happening at the local level, says Ron Smith, Executive Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at CCNC. The new VPs are Tammy McLean in Pinehurst, Jennifer Way Davis in Asheville, and Tara Kennard in Raleigh. Now we turn to the real estate page, and the major article on that page this week is Towers to Change, North Hills Skyline. The North Hills Skyline is set to change in the next year, with construction on track to begin in the coming months for several office and residential towers. Work will start in the spring on a project called the Towers of North Hills, Kane Realty Corporation President Mike Smith wrote in an email. The development includes a 575,000-square-foot residential tower that will front Six Forks Roads and rise 32 stories, just shy of the tallest tower in downtown Raleigh. That's the 33-story PNC Plaza. The building will have 308 luxury apartments and 185 boutique hotel rooms. Next door will be a 20-story Class A office building, totaling 650,000 square feet and sporting a conference center. Both are expected to open in mid-2020. The spring also will bring construction on a 33-acre parcel that Kane acquired along St. Albans Drive in Raleigh. The City Council approved an amendment to the North Hills East Master Plan last year to incorporate the property, clearing the way for new development. First up will be a residential project, Smith said, with groundbreaking expected in the spring. A site map for the parcel shows four residential buildings and two office buildings. The property also is being prepped to serve as an outdoor space for residents and workers. The area will also have an incredible park, which connects to the Greenway, Smith said. And in the merger department comes the article, George expected to lead the combined Cal-Atlantic-Lennar. The impending merger of Lennar Corporation and Cal-Atlantic Group, two of the Triangle's largest home builders, is expected to bring changes at the top for the new company's Raleigh office. Multiple sources say Troy George, division president of Cal-Atlantic Homes in Raleigh, will lead the new company. Calls to George were not returned. A Cal-Atlantic representative says the company won't discuss staffing decisions until the deal closes. That's expected to happen February the 12th, according to Lennar executives. George was division chief at Standard Pacific Homes when the company merged with the Ryland Group in 2015 to form Cal-Atlantic. Trish Hanchett is now the local division president of Lennar. The merger will create the largest home builder in the Triangle and the country. And in other news from the real estate front comes the article, East Raleigh Shopping Center Sold for $8 Million. A Canadian investor and developer has purchased an 8-acre shopping center in southeast Raleigh that's anchored by a Food Lion grocery store. A subsidiary of Skyline Investments paid $8.05 million for the property, according to Wake County Property Records. Other shops in the complex along Rock Quarry Road include Subway, Domino's, and a dentist office. The firm purchased the development from Cold Capital, an Arizona real estate investment company that previously bought the shopping center in 2014 as part of a larger deal that totaled $10.85 million. That transaction also included neighboring McDonald's, which Cold Capital still owns. And under the heading of Coming and Carry comes the article, Development with Wegmans Passes Major Hurdle. A 2.5 million square foot community, anchored by a new Wegmans grocery store, has gained a crucial rezoning approval January 25th from Cary Town Council, marking a major step for a project that will reshape Cary's Eastern Gateway. The council unanimously backed a change to the land use rules for a 92-acre undeveloped parcel owned by the state along Cary Town Boulevard. With the approval in hand, Columbia Development of South Carolina will be able to build 1.2 million square feet of Class A office space, more than 900 luxury residences, two boutique hotels, and 440,000 square feet of specialty retail. The project is expected to have an $850 million price tag. Cary is on the map, but this puts a big red dot on the map, Councilman Don France said shortly before the vote. The next step is for Columbia Development to bring forward specific development plans for the project, called Fenton, and close on the sale of the property. The project is one of several high-profile developments for the Eastern Gateway into Cary. Across the street, a new IKEA is planning to build its first triangle location at Cary Town Center. Tennessee-based CBL Properties also has submitted plans to redevelop the rest of the mall by building 600,000 square feet of office space and 800 housing units. The approval comes after more than 2 years of planning and months of discussions with Cary leaders and community members. In August, Columbia Development hosted a trip of a dozen Cary officials to Avalon, a development in Alpharetta, Georgia, that Columbia is using as a model for Fenton. Cary officials had told the firm to plan bigger, to incorporate more commercial, mixed-use buildings and spaces. The rezoning approval allows that to happen. The project falls within the new Eastern Cary Gateway Small Area Plan, adopted a little more than a year ago. The plan recommends that the Fenton site have a mix of commercial uses up to 15 stories in height, and also has guidelines for redevelopment at the Cary Town Center. This is an opportune time to build a project from the ground up, and we're thrilled to move forward with our plans to deliver cosmopolitan amenities to East Cary, says Abbott Goodwin, partner at the Columbia Development and Wake County resident. And now for news in real estate from around the state. The first article, New Greensboro Center has games on a grand scale. This from the Triad Business Journal. Though you may have been to a Dave and Buster's or other game-filled restaurant bar, chances are you've never seen anything like Round One Entertainment Center, which opens February the 3rd at the Four Seasons Town Center in Greensboro. Round One has more than 100 locations in Japan, but the Four Seasons location will be the first in North Carolina and the 20th in the United States. With more than 300 video games, 16 lanes of bowling, billiards, table tennis, karaoke rooms, and a variety of sports games, the 50,000-square-foot entertainment center hopes to bring customers to the mall. And from the Charlotte Business Journal comes the article, Charlotte Core Adding More Office Space and Housing. A lot more office housing and hotel rooms are coming to Charlotte's Center City, according to an annual report by Charlotte's Center City Partners that analyzes growth and development in Charlotte's urban core. Some of the key 2017 numbers, 1.4 million square feet of office space, 1,847 apartments, and 713 hotel rooms opened in the Center City. There's now 5.1 million square feet of office space planned or under construction, in addition to 840,000 square feet of retail, 8,363 housing units, and 2,276 hotel rooms. Also from the Charlotte Business Journal comes the article, Demand Drives Charlotte Airport Expansion. Passengers at Charlotte Douglas International Airport will get a glimpse of the future when an expanded concourse opens this summer. On January the 30th, airport executives led local reporters on a tour of the $200 million 9-gate Concourse A under construction, showing off a project that boasts wider pathways, higher ceilings, and places to power up your cell phone. It's expected to open by early July, the latest milestone in a 10-year, $2.5 billion makeover started in 2015 and known as Destination CLT. With the new gates, Charlotte Douglas will have 111 total. Seven of the nine gates on the expanded concourse will be used by United Airlines, Southwest, JetBlue, Frontier, and Air Canada. The other two gates will be controlled by the city and leased on an as-needed basis to various carriers. Jack Christine, Airport Chief Operating Officer, said the gates and concourse expansion will be at capacity from the start, a reflection of the demand overwhelming the existing terminal. A 750-foot fully enclosed walkway will take passengers from the main terminal to the new portion of Concourse A. Two additional expansions of Concourse A, each with 8 to 9 gates, are planned to the north, connecting with the 230,000-square-foot project that opens in the summer. Christine estimated the Concourse A addition opening later this year is 70% completed. It spans 110 feet, giving passengers more room to move around, 30 feet wider than the other CLT concourses. Christine estimated the next Concourse A addition would open within 3 years. After that, airport executives will determine when to move ahead on the final expansion of Concourse A. Christine said technology upgrades planned for the concourse include power outlets for charging smartphones and other gadgets next to each seat in passenger waiting areas. The 370 window panes in the building have unique computer location codes that connect with climate control systems to adjust tint and lighting, improving efficiency for heating and cooling systems. Concessions will include Smashburger, Panera Bread, Jamba Juice, and Starbucks, and a bar serving local craft beers. American Airlines operates its second largest hub in Charlotte. CLT has 720 daily departures and ranks amongst the nation's 10 busiest airports. Now we come to this week's cover story. And the article is Folwell Saves Dollars, but Misses Wall Street Run. While 2017 was a time of record rallies on Wall Street, the state of North Carolina's largest investor, its $100 billion pension fund, took the conservative approach. Attack officials meant losing out on some major return opportunities. Dale Folwell, in his first year as state treasurer, moved to shift more than $7 billion from equity funds into cash and bonds, a move that required a suspension of risk controls to make. "I don't have a crystal ball," he says. "I wasn't hired to have a crystal ball." Folwell is tasked with optimizing returns for the 900,000 state employees whose pensions he oversees. And, he insists, that includes fulfilling an oft-repeated campaign promise to cut Wall Street fees, which he did by calling all 175 managers in his first 100 days in office, conversations that resulted in fires, and negotiations that he says saved the state $60 million. But changing the mix also cost the fund in terms of potential gains, his department confirms. According to a November report, the state missed out on $414 million in potential gains during his first 11 months in office alone. While Folwell's office acknowledges that its public and private equity portfolio, that currently eclipses $45 billion, has performed worse than the S&P in 2017, so the private equity portfolio for the state is 13% gain, the S&P in 2017 was 20-plus percent gain. They're quick to point out the annual returns have been the third best in this century. In 2003, the equity portfolio returned 18.14%, and in 2009, the portfolio returned a shade more than 15%. But Folwell has been busy adjusting to many things other than investments. In a year full of transition, Folwell confirms 11 employees from a staff of about 40 in the investment management division, including its chief investment officer, Kevin Sigrist, have left the department since he took office. He also is in charge of the state health plan, which had a cash balance of $933.8 million in October that requires constant supervision to thwart inefficiencies and mismanagement. Whether Folwell's strategy of putting Wall Street managers on notice about fees is a good long-term strategy will be determined in the coming years as North Carolina maneuvers the needs of millions of its residents as the state continues to grow faster than almost any other state in the nation. Folwell's announced fight with Wall Street should not come as a surprise, since he insists the state should be involved in investments that he fully understands. That's precisely the reason he wants to beef up his internal team of managers rather than hire more managers from New York, Boston, and other places. Some may question the new makings of the state treasurer's office, led by a person who formerly received his CPA designation in 2015, a couple of years before his election. Folwell says he passed all four tests of the exam in the mid-1980s, and he simply completed the paperwork to receive the designation. The 59-year-old from Winston-Salem has quickly earned the reputation along Jones Street of a person who asks simple questions, but more importantly, relies on simple answers. To him, that makes the decision process easy. But Folwell's folksy style may be beginning to clash with the complexities of Wall Street finance. For now, however, Folwell insists the first year has been a success. He says he's giving the state more control over its own purse strings, while he takes stock of the heavy investing of his predecessor, Janet Caldwell. It's hard to go into a culture where no one thinks anything is wrong, Folwell says. Most experts, Folwell included, agree he inherited a fund that, comparatively speaking, is in good shape. When he entered the treasurer's seat, the teachers and state employees' retirement system was 91.6% funded by 2017. The fund was just $8 billion shy of what it would need to fund all future retiree pensions, faring far better than other states such as Connecticut and Kentucky, whose 2015 funding ratios were 47 and 44%, respectively. A recent survey by Spectrum Group shows that the majority of U.S. public pension plans are underfunded, and North Carolina, despite the math, has long been considered a solid fund nationally, often ranking among the top strongest public pension funds. But assuming that means North Carolina's fund is perfect is like saying, "We don't have a mortgage problem in 2007 because everybody's doing so well," says Michael Jacobs, a mergers and acquisitions advisor with Jacobs Capital and former head of corporate finance policy at the U.S. Treasury Department. Jacobs, who used to serve on the board of trustees at the North Carolina Teachers and State Employees Retirement System, credits North Carolina's historic pension fund successes to a supportive legislature, not to who has sat in the treasurer's seat. "The legislature makes sure it's fully funded, and they allocate the money that needs to be allocated," he says. "The goal is not to minimize expenses, it's to maximize returns, and that is not Folwell's focus," he says. But what Folwell has said he's trying to do is paint a more realistic picture of the pensions fund finances, specifically regarding the 7.2% return assumption. When actuaries calculate how funded the pension plan really is, they incorporate that assumed rate into the math, a rate that, for the past century, the state's pension coffer hasn't actually been able to hit. That's despite the fact that, according to an analysis by the American Legislative Exchange Council, it's below the average assumed rate of 7.34% among all public pension plans. In reality, the pension fund's performance over the past 10 years has been 5.1% annualized. ALEC, the Conservative American Legislative Exchange Council, claims in a recent report that states with overly optimistic presumed rates of returns are relying on unlikely long-term investment gains to remedy decades of underfunding the pension funds. But further reducing it carries a political problem, says Michael Mebbin, a member of the Board of Trustees of the Teachers and State Employees Retirement System. "It has an immediate impact on the funding ratio and the required contributions by the employees, in this case, the state, the local government," he says. "It's a hard pill to swallow." So Folwell plans to lower that assumed return rate gradually so as not to shock the system, Mebbin says. Last year, he reduced it from 7.25% to 7.2%. And Folwell says it's a big deal, big enough that he's okay with being the first treasurer in our history to have a lower funded pension plan at the end of my term versus the first of my term. Instead of doing something that makes the plan look funded like treasurers usually do, I went the other direction, he adds. But Andrew Sultan, a former deputy treasurer of investments for the North Carolina Pension, says it's not really as significant an action as Folwell represents. The changes that he's making in reducing the target or the assumed rate is really not a big change, because you get a couple really good years in the stock market, and you'll beat either number, he says. The reason he's taking small steps is because if he takes larger steps, the only way to fill in the hole is to ask the legislature for more money, and that's a political calculation as to whether the legislature would be willing to pony up what it would take. Jacobs and Mebbin both voted against the initial 7.25% assumed rate of return in the first place. Jacobs, calling it unrealistic, says the figure is the main reason he resigned. But he agrees that just lowering the number isn't the solution. Lowering the number is being transparent about the reality, he says. There are three solutions: lowering benefits or allocating more tax dollars to the pension system. Neither ideal for North Carolina constituents. Or there's the third way: get better returns. And the assets that provide the biggest returns are largely in the private and public equity space, where the management fees are the highest. And that's where Folwell has gone to eliminate fees, by his own admission, firing numerous managers to cut down on Wall Street costs. To eliminate private equity because the expenses are high is saying you're not going to invest in the assets that produce the best returns, Jacobs says. It's the wrong metric. The metric you should be focused on is risk-adjusted returns after fees. Fees are higher among private equity assets because it takes 100 times as much effort to own a private company as to own stock in a public company, Jacobs says. Overall, the pension plan grew $10 billion from June 30th of 2016 to November the 30th of 2017, but the amount in public equities rose by just $1.3 billion. Sultan, too, thinks the state is cutting costs at the expense of opportunities. I think it's safe to say the opportunity cost of eliminating the equity exposure probably cost the pension plan, Sultan says. I think it's a function of having a long-term view of the market. Folwell says fee reduction was part of his long-term view, and then in calling managers, he was able to identify redundancies, such as where the state split its business with two accounts and was not getting the buying power of that total relationship. In one case, fees went down by $2.5 million just for 2017. By reducing the outside managers to 160, the state's in a better position, he says. When I got there, the cash flow of the fund the year before I got there, we paid out billions of dollars more than we took in, he said. We had negative cash flows of billions of dollars. His predecessor's decision to commit nearly $7 billion in 2016 gave him pause, he says. I don't invest in things I don't understand, he said, noting that while he understands the equity market very well, he didn't, at least until those fee manager phone calls, understand the full extent of the situation. To take money from managers who have been underperforming their benchmarks for years and put it right back into something that had the fee structure that this plan has traditionally allocated assets to is not something I was comfortable with. So instead, he funneled a much more conservative figure, $250 million, into real estate investments and sticks to his decision, he says. Overall, Sultan compares Folwell's job with steering a huge aircraft carrier. With a huge ship, you're not going to turn it very quickly. It's just too darn big, he said. You've really got to start thinking where your returns are going to come from. You've got to start with a long-term view. You're going to have exposure to equity. At the end of the day, whether your expected return is 7.25, 7, or 6.5, if you don't have the exposure, there's no way you're ever going to earn that long-term return, because bonds don't earn anything close to that, and real estate's not going to earn that either. He suspects Folwell tried to time the market, something Folwell, in his own comments, denies. I think, he thought, if the market's going up, I sell several billion dollars worth of stock. The market goes down, I'll have saved the pension plan from the drop, and I'll have the opportunity to put the money back into the market for better prices, Silton says. It didn't work out. He says Folwell's campaign promises to reduce fees by $100 million dictated 2017. The only way to do that quickly was to fire equity managers, he said, noting that if he had been in the office, reducing fees would have been the last thing he looked at after reviewing the asset split. For his part, Folwell admits his pledge to cut fees paid into his motivation and is unapologetic. That's why I was hired, he says, recounting calling dozens of managers in his first weeks on the job. By the 10th and 12th calls, they already knew what he was calling about, he said. And not everybody thinks Folwell's trajectory misses the mark. Mebbin points to Folwell's continuation of a strategy started by Cowell, the creation of a state index fund that will maintain our public equity exposure at a much lower cost. He says Folwell, like Cowell, is an awesome treasurer, and that the state is well on its way to turning the aircraft carrier in the proper direction. Folwell, for his part, is confident it's the right path, though he cautions that the challenges are immense. In 1974, 248 individuals aged 90 and up were getting checks, he says. Now that figure is higher than 7,100. As long as I'm the treasurer, I'm going to preserve, strengthen, and try to sustain this plan for another 50 years, he said. As for Caldwell, she declined to comment on Folwell's performance. When you leave a church, she says, you let the new minister do his thing and give him that space. The executive voice for this week's Triangle Business Journal belongs to Bridget Harrington. Bridget is the executive director of Innovate Raleigh. The mission of Innovate Raleigh is to serve as a catalyst for innovation and entrepreneurship in the region. And the organization's new executive director, Bridget Harrington, is looking to bring that mission to fruition. Part of that effort will be leading the six-year-old entity in its new alliance with the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce that's designed to assist the startup community. Harrington, who began her role December the 19th, will draw from her own entrepreneurial experience to push Innovate Raleigh to become one of the top centers for innovation and entrepreneurship in the U.S. Triangle Business Journal caught up with her to learn how she plans to accomplish that goal and others. So here's the Q&A. What experiences in your professional background have best prepared you for your current role? I have over 10 years of leadership experience in finance, operations, and marketing at organizations of all scales, from startups to large corporations. As Director of Revenue at The Bold Italic in San Francisco, I worked on Gannett's innovation team, where we crafted and executed a growth strategy for the local publication. Prior to joining Gannett, I co-founded, built, and sold Syndicate Media Group, a marketing and communications firm. With offices in New York and Los Angeles, Syndicate Media Group's team of 40 serviced top clients in the U.S. and internationally, including Soho House, Gramercy Park Hotel, Ace Hotels, Coca-Cola, and Microsoft. As a former entrepreneur, I understand what it takes to operate a lean, highly effective organization that can empower a passionate team to do their best work. Most recently, I was at KPMG, working on some of the leading venture capital firms in Silicon Valley. So how will this new alliance with the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce impact startups locally? Innovate Raleigh began with two remarkable founders, Marianne Baldwin and Terry Lomax, along with an incredible group of advisors. As the organization developed, it became clear that Innovate Raleigh was having a real impact on the local entrepreneurial and innovation ecosystem. The partnership with the Chamber is an important next step in continuing to foster the community's growth. Working together with leaders at the Chamber, we'll be focused on cultivating a healthy ecosystem for the next generation of entrepreneurs to build dynamic businesses that create economic opportunity for Raleigh. So what are your short and long-term goals? In my first few weeks, I've been focused on listening to the community to better understand the organization and the ecosystem. I'm working closely with Innovate Raleigh's Board of Directors on a rapid strategic planning process that will clarify the vision and goals of the organization for the next 2 to 5 years. In the meantime, our objective is to fill the gaps in the local innovation ecosystem and address the needs of entrepreneurs. A recent organizational assessment indicated that our local entrepreneurs are looking for assistance in funding, talent, and advocacy. So what gives entrepreneurs in this area an advantage over similar regions? Raleigh has a uniquely collaborative culture that fosters creativity and innovation. Our community also has an incredible advantage in our quality of life. Of course, we'll lose this advantage without smart housing and transportation policy, and I look forward to working with our partners as the city and county addresses these issues. So what keeps you up at night? My 2-year-old son. Finally, what book is currently on your nightstand? Principles, Life and Work by Ray Dalio. It's an inspiring memoir from one of the most successful investors and entrepreneurs in the history of finance. Now we come to the viewpoint page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and the editor's notebook is entitled, Folwell Needs to Return, Focus on Returns, Not Just Fees. There's something about North Carolina Treasurer Dale Folwell that's very likable. For one, he's prepared with charts, graphs, and trend reports when you talk to him about the challenges of managing a $100 billion pension fund that provides the monetary safety net for more than 900,000 retired state employees. It's a big responsibility, and Folwell takes it seriously. But one also gets the vibe that he may be too serious and too rigid to listen to other ideas that may actually bring better returns for the fund, and as a result, may create needless stress for the North Carolina legislature to support the state's financial obligations with additional taxpayer dollars. Folwell's portfolio strategy missed most of the meteoric stock market run last year, but he's quick to point out that almost half of the fund's assets are tied to public and private equities, and the annual returns were the third best in this century. All true. But the returns were lower than the benchmark S&P index, and by the department's own admission, it may have lost out on some $400 million in stock market windfall last year. Folwell lost his chief investment officer last year over the fund's portfolio strategy, according to several people close to the department. Talk to Folwell for a few minutes and one can understand why there may be disagreements. During the election campaign, Folwell talked about exuberant management fees charged by Wall Street and other high-flying managers. He made sure he kept true to his campaign promise once he took office, and he saved the state $60 million with the prospect of saving millions more in the future, and that's a very good thing. But that simply could not be Folwell's singular goal when it comes to investment management of the fund. He has to rely on people who can devise a safe and calculated way to extract the best returns for the fund. Those individuals may be from New York or Singapore, and that should be fine. The goal is to get the fund bringing enough returns to support the obligations we have for our retired state workers and not rely on lawmakers siphoning money. Simply cutting fees will not get us to the goal, and Folwell knows it. North Carolina's pension fund is in good shape when compared to most states, and North Carolinians should be happy that someone who gets to work at 5:45 every morning is looking after their retirement income. Folwell's job is hard, but he may have made it harder on himself by keeping his eye solely focused on fees and not run with one of history's most amazing bull markets. But he's only 1 year into his job. He's learned some things, and we hope the fund returns will speak for themselves in the future. And today's guest column on the Viewpoint page is authored by R.J. Lehman, who's Director of Finance, Insurance, and Trade Policy for the R Street Institute. It's a free market think tank based in Washington, D.C. With North Carolina Insurance Commissioner Mike Causey's recent decision to reject the proposed rate increases filed in November by the North Carolina Rate Bureau, state homeowners await the results of a July 23rd hearing in Raleigh to learn by how much, if at all, their rates might rise. The Rate Bureau's requested average rate hike of 18.7% statewide was bound to be controversial, drawing objections from realtors, home builders, and coastal residents who feel they already pay too much for home insurance. But what the debate really underlines is that the time has come to modernize North Carolina's antiquated regulatory system for insurance. Private insurance companies are showing great reluctance to write new property insurance in the state. Since 2011, the state's beach plan, which writes policies in the coastal zone, has seen its market share grow from 3.4% to 7.2%. The FAIR plan, which serves as an insurer of last resort statewide, has grown from 0.6% of the market to 2.4% over the same period. With such large residual insurance markets, insurers who are already skittish about inadequate rates also must account for the risk that a large event like 2011's Hurricane Irene, which forced the state's insurers to pay out $1.18 in claims for every dollar they collected in premium, could lead to huge assessments on the entire industry. These hurricane taxes ultimately are passed on to consumers in the form of special charges on every insurance policy in the state. North Carolina is the only state in the nation where personal insurance rates are still set collectively by a rate bureau. The system amounts to a cartel that discourages competition. North Carolina insurance consumers are denied innovative new product offerings and lose out on discounts they could otherwise earn for hardening their homes against storms. The current system also turns what should be a technical evaluation of rates into a charged political issue. For the elected insurance commissioner, the temptation to allow voter sentiments and special interest lobbying to trump dispassionate analysis is strong. That's a big part of why homeowners insurers have only been allowed to raise rates twice in the past decade, a 4% hike in 2009 and a 7% increase in 2013. Lawmakers should consider raising the standard deductible to match private offerings, limited participation to those consumers who truly can't find private coverage, and creating a takeout program, such as the one Florida used to shrink the size of its Citizens Property Insurance Corp. from 14.3% of the market in 2011 to just 4.3% in 2016. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Once again, that's 919-832-5138.